Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Chris Toney has worked in hospital admissions for over three decades. Until now, she never considered joining a union, but she has changed her mind.
If you try to address these big issues by yourself, I don't think you're going to get anywhere. You need to stand together as a group and sit at the table and negotiate change. I don't think it's going to happen one-on-one.
Next week, some hospital support workers in Eugene, Oregon, will vote on union representation. Reporter Tiffany Eckert spoke with some of those workers. Also on the show, Coast Community Radio's Kate Brister talks with Tillamook mystery author Arlene Sacchitano. And later, what happens when a major brewery makes a little local one change its name? Little guys have a big party. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Next week, frontline hospital workers like surgical support aides and housekeepers at Peace Health Sacred Heart Hospitals in Eugene and Springfield, Oregon, will vote on whether or not to unionize. Tiffany Eckert reports from Eugene.
Chris Tonry has worked in patient admissions at Sacred Heart for 36 years. She's never been part of a union. Next week, she plans to check the yes box to join Service Employees International Union Local 49. Tonry believes a union could help with inadequate pay raises and understaffing.
If you try to address these big issues by yourself, I don't think you're going to get anywhere. You need to stand together as a group and sit at the table and negotiate change. I don't think it's going to happen one-on-one.
In a written statement, Peace Health's Chief Administrative Officer Randall Leary says, quote, "Although we certainly support our caregivers' right to seek third-party representation, we prefer a relationship where issues of importance can be directly addressed," end quote. Over the last year, union organizers have met with the almost 1,100 Peace Health frontline hospital workers and recently filed a petition to unionize. Amanda Harp is a mental health tech at Sacred Heart University District. She thinks a union will give workers in her department a say in important policy decisions. Harp also believes union bargaining could lead to better medical insurance coverage.
I have a coworker right now whose wife works at Starbucks, and they decided that the Starbucks insurance was better and more affordable than what the hospital provides.
Both Tonry and Harp say they know hospital employees who have been sent to collections or had wages garnished over unpaid balances for treatment at the hospital where they work. On pay raises and medical insurance plans at Peace Health, Randall Leary says, quote, "We routinely survey the market to determine where our caregivers fit and make adjustments to maintain a competitive median market position," end quote. Peace Health Sacred Heart Service employees will vote yes or no to unionize on May 27th and 28th. I'm Tiffany Eckert reporting.
Thirty-five years ago this week, Mount St. Helens erupted in southwest Washington. The explosive force of the volcano turned what started as a beautiful spring day into one enveloped by darkness and ash. 57 people died as a result of the eruption. This is the story of two eyewitnesses in their own voice.
My name is Carolyn Dreger. I am a hydrologist here at the U.S. Geological Survey Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington.
My name's Dan Miller. I'm a geologist, retired from the U.S. Geological Survey.
The morning of May 18, 1980, I started out in Vancouver, Washington. A colleague and I decided that we would head north and try to get some understanding of how this reawakening and heating volcano was going to affect the glaciers. So about 8 o'clock in the morning, we left Vancouver and began our drive up north.
I left about 8 or a little after 8 a.m. in the morning and headed up Interstate 5. As I passed the Ridgefield exit on I-5, it just happens that there's a beautiful clear view off to the northeast to Mount St. Helens. And I looked over there and it was a beautiful, bright, sunny morning.
We're really surprised that the volcano took on a very different appearance. All we saw was an enormous gray cloud enveloping the volcano, especially on its northern side.
I saw this huge mushroom cloud go up above the top of Mount St. Helens and just boiled rapidly up into the sky.
And the cloud didn't just go horizontally, it seemed to move up and over the terrain. It was about that time that we realized that we were having a massive event on a scale unlike any that we'd ever seen.
The force of the eruption was unimaginable. What happened there was essentially, envision it as a hot cloud, like hundreds of degrees Fahrenheit, moving across the landscape at 650 miles an hour with debris bouncing around it at boulders and rocks and things like that. I mean, it swept mature 300-foot tall virgin forest trees out of the ground, ripped them out of the ground and carried them miles away, roots and all. So I can't imagine anything that could withstand that kind of impact.
Late in the afternoon in downtown Vancouver, I went outside and it was very eerie outside this little volcano observatory. The volcanic ash plume was hanging overhead. It was very dark. The birds were not singing. The streets were somewhat deserted. And I think that everyone in Southwest Washington was in a little bit of disbelief as to what was happening.
May 18 was a tough day for me because what I haven't mentioned yet is that my buddy Dave Johnston, who was a USGS scientist, spent the night up there that night, the night of May 17th.
A helicopter set out to go and see if they could rescue David Johnston. They flew up the Toutle River Valley, but they could not even recognize the landscape. The landscape had changed so drastically that there were no landmarks to tell them where they were. And with all the ash in the air, they had to turn around and come back. When I saw those scientists come back, very crestfallen, a little bit in shock, I realized that it would be impossible for Dave to survive that eruption.
In the twinkling of an eye, literally from one day to the next, that huge area was transformed into a lunar landscape. It was like walking on the moon. There was nothing but gray. A gray color, everything was covered with ash, everything was destroyed, all the trees were gone, all of the animals were killed. There was not a sound, there were no insects, there were no birds, there was nothing, and it was a barren landscape.
Once you see a volcano erupt, you're never the same again, you never forget what it's like.
In some ways, it was shocking, and in other ways, that new landscape has its own beauty. And I learned to appreciate the fact that, you know, whoa, I loved what was there before, but this is really interesting.
The eruption of Mount St. Helens drastically changed the region's landscape. Much of the mountain's exploded top ended up in streams and rivers that nearby towns relied on for water. Conrad Wilson reports the city of Longview is still struggling with its water supply.
Dawn Wagg Campbell sits on the front porch of her house in Longview, Washington.
We're looking at a green pan that we have boiled water in 12 different times.
The pot's caked with a hard, white, chalky material.
We do 1 gallon of water, boil it down to nothing, and then we put another one in, boil it down to nothing. And I did it kind of as a project.
In a way, the problems the city's having with its water today date back to the May 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens. Tim Kuhn is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He's standing on a dam that cuts across the North Fork of the Toutle River. On a clear day, Kuhn says, Mount St. Helens is just off in the distance.
What we're seeing here is a result of the eruption.
Treed hillsides line the walls of a massive river valley. In spots, the river looks like it's hardly moving. It's wide and flat. The river essentially flows through a giant sandbox.
That's Mount St. Helens working its way down in the form of sand.
At the dam, the river narrows and picks up speed, carrying with it the tiny remains of what was once the top of Mount St. Helens.
The point of the dam is just that, to help us manage the sediment that's coming off of the mountain.
Kuhn says for about a decade, the dam caught most of the sediment, but around 1998, the sediment pushed the water around the dam, meaning more of Mount St. Helens flowed down the Cowlitz River, where the city of Longview drew its drinking water. In January 2013, the city switched from taking water out of the Cowlitz to an aquifer in town. There were several reasons for that switch, including endangered fish and pollution. But one of the major reasons, volcanic sediment, caused all kinds of problems. Todd Douglas is a water quality specialist with the city. He's at the old pump house on the banks of the Cowlitz River.
It looks a lot like sand, but it's really a volcanic ash, and it's extremely abrasive, and it really wears down metal.
The normal water pump should last you 20 years, but you guys were getting, what, five years out of them before they'd have to be rebuilt?
Amy Blaine is an engineer with the city, and while it's clear to her that the volcanic sand caused all kinds of engineering headaches, she says the change to groundwater has also been challenging for some parts of Longview.
There's a lot of fear about the location of this plant and its proximity to industrial activity across the street.
From the city's pump houses that draw from the aquifer, it's easy to see a pulp and paper mill, and the wells aren't far from an old aluminum factory. Blaine says the water is safe, but that's of little comfort to Jen Matthews, who lives in Longview.
Now, remember, this is now dried, but this was what was coming into our homes through the pipes.
Matthews is sifting her hands through a bucket of dusty rocks that leave her palm stained a sort of iron red. This is also the water that Wyle Campbell boiled to uncover that white chalky powder. When the city changed its water supply in 2013, it reversed the flow through the city and freed up decades of mineral deposits in its water pipes. Since then, the city has replaced some pipes. But Matthew says even though the discolored water has disappeared, it smells like chlorine and leaves mineral spots on dishes and kitchen countertops.
We will never drink it. I don't cook with it. I don't rinse our food with it. I don't brush my teeth with it. I do have to shower with it.
A citizens' advisory committee will make recommendations this summer. City officials say one option would be for the city to return to the Cowlitz River. I'm Conrad Wilson in Longview, Washington.
Tillamook author Arlene Sacitano loves the craft of writing. She also loves libraries. She spoke with Coast Community Radio's Kate Brister about that love and how she shares it.
Joining us in the studio is Tillamook author Arlene Sacitano. Arlene was in Napa yesterday to award a $1,000 grant from the international organization Sisters in Crime. Sisters in Crime supports and promotes women suspense writers and readers. They also love books, bookstores. They love libraries. Arlene, welcome. Please tell us about yourself and about Sisters in Crime and about loving libraries.
Well, I'm a mystery writer. And I've had my mystery novels published for about 10 years. Sisters in Crime has played a big role in my writing. It's a national organization of women mystery writers. They were founded their original statement was to level the playing field, because 30 years ago, women mystery writers could barely get any reviews in national publications. The percentages were, of all the major publications across the country that reviewed mysteries, only 15% of the mysteries reviewed were written by women, even though there were 50% of the mysteries were being written by women. And so a couple of the successful mystery writing women got together and said, we want to change this. And so they founded this organization kind of in a motel room at a convention, and they got together and decided that, first of all, they were going to survey all the publications every year and send those publications their results. And then they also started with encouraging people who were successful female mystery writers to help the people who were just starting out and didn't get the press and airtime that the more successful people did. And so 30 years later, we haven't reached parity yet, but it's about 45% are now reviewed of women mystery writers are now reviewed.
And now the organization is strong enough, it's reaching out. As an example, the We Love Bookstores, We Love Libraries campaign, some young readers and writers, what did you have to say to them?
Mainly about writing, how to start writing, kind of some of the pitfalls of beginning writing, and just kind of tried to cover the basics like that, kind of eased them into the idea that they weren't going to make $1 million right out of the gate, probably. and uh, And anyway, they were very receptive. About half a dozen of them identified themselves as writers already.
Oh,
so,
very good.
Yeah, so that was kind of fun to see.
So Loose Threads is the name of your series, mm-hmm. and it's the name of the quilting group that meets in the quilt shop of your protagonist, Harriet Truman. Now, characters, your settings will be familiar to North Coast readers. Foggy Point, Washington feels a lot like Astoria in a climate and in the character of the people. They're good people. Even when they're doing bad things to each other, they're very good people. Is there a real Foggy Point? Is there a real quilt shop? Is there a real steaming cup coffee shop that you're channeling?
It's fictitious. And the Foggy Point is based on kind of a combination of the places I've been, a little bit on Port Townsend. But Port Townsend didn't have, and, you know, I spend a lot of my time in Tillamook, and we certainly don't have a large enough population that I could kill off very many people. And so I had to make up a town that had a slightly larger population. But it's my real inspiration for it was Port Townsend, Washington. I liked the idea of the water kind of on three sides, and I wanted to be able to isolate them, which I finally did in, I think it's book five, The Quilt Before the Storm. I wanted, because in Tillamook it often happens, when we have a storm, trees go over the highway and we're isolated until they find where the problem is. So I wanted to have that, only, of course, in literature you want it to be even more extreme. So I have one road going in and out so that I could have a storm, a slide take out the road, and the ladies in that book, the ladies are stuck in town with no police, no power, and a killer on the loose.
Your characters, I've noticed, are women who use the creativity of quilting to relax, to problem solve. You're an experienced quilter, knitter as well, mm-hmm. I understand. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the side benefits of quilting and fabric work, aside from the magnificent quilts. What are you getting out of it, and how are these ladies using this to really make their minds work through these problems?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The market studies show that the average age of the quilter is 62 years old. And so I think a lot of people turn to quilting when they've raised their families or they have finished their, you know, working career. And it's a creative outlet that's accessible to a lot of people, and it allows the people to come together. Quilt shops often have activities that revolve around making a project where there's a show and tell involved. People who might be isolated at home, maybe they're widowed or maybe they, you know, live alone for other reasons, and it gives them a chance to come in and to a group. So it kind of builds in a camaraderie that you sometimes don't find in other activities.
Well, and that reminds me of a point that I saw in your dialogue, too. Your descriptions and your plot points you get through pretty quickly, but you really do enjoy nice, juicy, long pages of dialogue, and it reminds me of a quilting bee where there might be several little conversations going on all at once, but you're aware of them, and then all of a sudden when something happens, all the attention is focused on a very minute detail. And I thought that really captured the spirit of the quilting bee.
And of course, we have our token males, the love interest. And then we have Jorge, who may develop into an older love interest, who does the cooking.
Well, Arlene, it's been wonderful to talk with you today about your work. And thank you again to you and Sisters in Crime on behalf of Napa High School. For Coast Community Radio, this is Kate Brister.
Just over a year ago, a small group of partners opened a brewery in one of Washington's smallest counties. In its first year, Drop Anchor Brewery in Cathlamet opened its brew house to local customers and grew its overall sales to distribute its product to over 60 locations throughout the state. The success of the beer sales also drew attention from far beyond Washington. When Anchor Brewing in San Francisco, known for its Anchor Steam beer, became aware of the existence of Drop Anchor Brewery, the much larger company let the little guys know there was going to be a tussle over the word Anchor in the new brewery's name. Richard Erickson, managing partner in the small company, explained how Anchor Brewing lowered their boom.
6 months ago, Anchor Brewing Company out of San Francisco chose to send us a cease and desist letter because we were using the word Anchor, Anchor being trademarked by them for Anchor Brewing 100 years ago. So with that cease and desist, we could not use the word Anchor, so we had to change our name from Drop Anchor to something else.
Erickson said a name change is a costly enterprise, affecting everything from stationery to promotional items to its web presence, so a new approach went into deciding a new brewery name.
Well, we didn't get to decide on the name. The lawyers did. We had almost 400 names submitted that we looked through. We narrowed it down to 200, then to 100, got down to 50 and started doing Google. So many names were obvious that we couldn't use, like Drop Sale, because there's Full Sail Brewing. So a lot of the words that you see that deals with the river and ships and ocean and fun things that we wanted to keep has already been used either in a brewery name or a beer name. Even Rusty Bucket was taken.
The brewery debuted its new name this past weekend at its one-year anniversary party. Locals turned out to celebrate and to bid on merchandise with the old name and logo.
All right, Barry's bringing me the bucket. We needed someone to draw the winning ticket for the 4 o'clock drawing.
We have a winner.
All right. So for this drawing, you get your choice of size of a drop anchor mermaid T-shirt, which will be a collector's item in about 10 minutes. And one of our famous growlers that we hopefully you'll fill before you leave.
Yeah.
And finally, a banner featuring the new brewery name, River Mile 38 Brewery, was unveiled to an enthusiastic audience by partners Richard Erickson and Barry Ayton.
Okay, everybody, I know everybody's been waiting for this. As you may know, in this world, people can trademark logos and names. And there is a company in San Francisco called Anchor Brewing. You probably know them as Anchor Steam. They've only been around 100 years. Here we are, little Calflamet with our little drop anchor, and they sent the big bag lawyers after us and said, you have to cease and desist. You can no longer use the word anchor. Anchor's trademarked in the beer, wine, and spirits business.
We must be threatening them.
We are scaring the hell out of them with good beer.
Yeah.
So we went on a search, and our founders all submitted names, our friends submitted names, we dreamed up names. So I'm going to let Barry tell you a little bit about the process, and then we'll announce the name.
It was a long and windy, arduous road to find a name. There are so many names that are taken in it one way or another. Even though we are Drop Anchor, and even though we weren't exactly like Anchor, it didn't matter. You know, they had the trademark, Deep Pockets. Big Bully Beer came after us and stepped on us, and they weren't nice about it. And finally, we came up with a great idea. You know, thanks to the community, we reached out to everybody in our brewery family, and we came up with a name that is very close to our hearts because it is associated with this point on the river. We had to get a trademark attorney. We went through the process. Everything's good. We got rubber stamped, and here we are today. We're going to unveil the new name here.
After the announcement, managing partner Erickson took a minute to express appreciation for the brewery's community and core group of local customers.
I am so pleased at how the local people here carried us through the winter. Now, it was very exciting when we first opened. It was a great, fun summer last year when the yachters and the tourists came in. But when the rains came and it got cold and windy, it was the local people that came down and spent their Fridays and Saturdays with us to allow us to stay open. Of course, it's easy now. The sun's coming out. The boaters are coming. The people are coming. And so the business is starting to pick up. What was fun is to be able to do charity events for all the different community. We even were allowed to give money to the high school kids to help them build their stadium. And it's difficult to give beer money to high school kids. We try to sponsor a lot of charities, try to help out our community, and try to bring people into our town.
The brewery, formerly known as Drop Anchor, is now River Mile 38 Brewing Company in Calflamet, Washington. They open their brew house to the public every Friday and Saturday from 4 to 8 p.m. And that is all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1. That's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you
for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.